I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Padraig Reedy. This week, Ejet Melgren returns Little Atoms to tell us about her new book, Together, 10 Choices for a Better Now.
So, Ejet Melgren, welcome back to Little Atoms. You were last with us in 2019 to talk about How to Lose a Country, and you're back today to talk about Together, 10 Choices for a Better Now. We normally start this podcast asking people what their books are about, but I think with this one, maybe the more pertinent question is, what is this book for?
No, great question. Thank you, Padraig, for having me again. It's always a pleasure. Very good question, because I was so afraid to be asked of this question, what's the book about? You know, nowadays, when you write the book, you also have to formulate the book for, good sound bites and everything. And this book is not, quite convenient for that one. How to Lose a Country was, and it was, made people angry. It gave, topics for discussions, for dinner parties, and to be angry about, and so on. But now this one, I'm asking something from people. So I'm not even sure it's a book. It's maybe like cardiac massage for on the heart of humankind. And it's also a talisman in this age of collapse for the humans, how to, and I'm trying to tell them how to survive morally, and also how to, and how I need them to get together to change the course of history. So this is for, I'm sure it will sound quite ambitious, but this is a book for people who need to transform their selves in order to appear in 21st century as the humans, as better humans. Yeah, I can say that.
I think when we spoke in 2019, we were, in the grip of, depression in the season, and we were still very much, Brexit was just everywhere, Trump was everywhere, and almost now already it's very hard to remember that time, because of course we've been overwhelmed by something else again. But the obvious thing that's happened since How to Lose a Country is the pandemic, and the book starts with a very familiar pandemic kind of scene that I think a lot of people remember, just kind of seeing your neighbor in the midst of all this, and just thinking, both having that moment of realizing how mad all this is. But what in the world has, apart from maybe the kind of this massive thing, and it's very hard to think about anything else in some ways, but what do you think has changed since How to Lose a Country?
One thing changed. How to Lose a Country became a timely book in 2 years. I was especially for Western countries, I was a bit of ahead, I think. Mm. I was trying to convince them this is coming towards you as well. I mean, what had happened in Turkey will, in a similar way, will happen to you. And it was mostly, especially the book events all around the world were mostly about trying to convince them what they are going through is a step towards fascism, towards an authoritarian system, not with uniform and boots, but with funny hair and orange skin, maybe. So, you know, and it was really hard because one, I'm an outsider. I'm a woman with curly hair coming from a crazy country called Turkey. So it's not easy for me to convince. It's not easy for them to take me seriously. And, the, you know, Western politics is not very, neither open nor used to listening its story from an outsider, whereas we are, like Turkish or Middle Eastern countries are, we're quite used to that. So, yeah, and now I'm seeing people are more and more talking about how to lose a country, which is a tragic fact for me, because now I wrote a new book. And I want to say, chap, read that, get depressed. And then now, I have a yellow book that will cheer you up. No, it's not cheering up. One thing I noticed, actually, like, it has been only a few days that the book is published, but several people talked about it, and I read reviews and so. It's funny, actually, it's kind of strange. How to Lose a Country invigorated people more, because it was, you know, something, it was alarming, let's say. But then this is, as you said, as we said in the beginning, it's asking for something from people. So everybody, you know, many people, I felt like, you know, they are like muted. First, is this a political book? It's maybe not. It looks like a self-help book because it's yellow, very yellow. And what is it? What do you want from us? And so on. So I'm in a very interesting situation nowadays. I want people, I hope, sooner than 2 years, as it happened in How to Lose a Country, to realize that this is the new politics. The new politics will be about emotions, because as we know, you know, all these authoritarian leaders and right-wingers and so on have been doing a lot of politics of emotions. They were playing on emotions. So I think progressive politics should also consider to think and talk about emotions as well. We shouldn't shy away from it. Mm-hmm. These, you know, I wanted to write about those words we generally shy away from as progressive people, like love, faith, you know, and all those.
Not practical programs for government, but actually talking about, you know, I guess, yeah, it's something we'll come back to. Now, you talk about emotions, and the book is learned, you know, the chapter titles, you know, say, you know, are all engaged with different emotions, pretty much. You know, we talk about befriending fear, choosing dignity over pride, and everything is presented as how you can choose things. There is one point in the middle of the book where you describe talking to your therapist about giving up on anger. Tell me how and when that happened, because it's not something I ever would have imagined would happen with you, Jack.
Yeah. Well, okay, let's start with this. I became really famous in Turkey at some point when I was in this political debate show, and there was this populist supporter, diehard supporter of Erdogan, and we were discussing something. And at some point, the idiocy and the banality and the, you know, vulgarity of the whole discussion, or not discussion, his vulgarity,
yeah,
and his stoneheadedness, whatever, infuriate me so much so that I asked the question, when did you become so cruel? And then I went on talking, like, very angry. People loved it. This, you know, that video clip has become very popular and so on. And then I remember this video clip and how it became famous in Turkey and how it functioned actually in the political scene during those days. And I came to conclusion that anger, especially the anger of an intellectual, anger of the opinion leader, is seen as a spectacle. And they're actually watching you. You're becoming a spectacle itself and forgetting about actually what you're talking about and why you're angry and so on. And you are kind of channeling their anger into public space, so they are, you know, going through this catharsis moment. And this doesn't change the history, obviously. And then I thought about this excessive expression of anger and how it actually, you know, invades our communication sphere and how ineffective, how inconsequential actually it has become. Mm-hmm. So, and then, you know, personally, I started losing anger, not, you know, the dynamic anger. I think I personally replaced it with attention. And then I saw that like the social media is already commodifying our anger, all emotions, but mostly anger. And when an emotion can be commodified, can we still use it as an emotion, a fundamental emotion, to build political action upon? I don't think so. Mm-hmm. And it also, this, you know, expression of anger, especially on social media, creates the illusion that we are politically engaged.
Yeah.
Or actually, it creates this illusion that you are politically engaged and you are showing it off. Not showing, you know, but you are like proving that you are politically engaged. You are not, you know, one of those people who feel fucking nothing and so on.
Yeah.
So that anger does not interest me anymore. And attention instead is the determination of being, of keeping your anger refined, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And this expression of anger and the, you know, elevating the anger degree and so on, it is not sustainable. How can you be angry all the time?
Yeah.
How can you be angry all the day? Anger is a passing by emotion. It's not a thing that you can hold to for fucking forever. So yeah, this is why I think we need to think about attention. I am not the only person, or I'm not the first person to say this. It's a tradition. You know, I told it about this in the book, Iris Murdoch, Hannah Arendt, Simone Weil. Funnily enough, they're all female. They thought about this.
Mm.
Because it's important, you know, it is important when attention is mentioned by a woman.
Yeah.
Because we are, as a gender, banned from being angry.
Mm.
That's why sometimes we might even need to be angry just to oppose that dominant understanding of female. But still, despite this fact, I think we can, as women as well, can think about attention and can build our political action upon the concept of attention rather than anger.
Mm-hmm. So it becomes a deeper, you know, more genuine, I guess almost a, you know, the attention would imply, you know, that we're, you know, focusing on something and figuring out and trying to actually solve a problem rather than reacting.
Because
so much of, I guess,
I interrupted. Attention is a commitment, whereas anger is a reaction. So yeah, and the reaction is always connected to action. So what if there is no action, and if you are only consist of reaction? So attention is a deliberate commitment to watch what's happening, but not only watch, but be an active agent within the political sphere. So yeah, that's why anger, although it feels like there's too much, you know, action in anger. Anger implies that. Actually, I think attention is the real thing that changes the political sphere and changes the course of the time.
Mm. I think something that struck me reading those, when we talked about the very start of the show, was that, you know, the right is very good at talking about raw emotion. And yeah, you combine that with social media, which is about constant churn of emotion. They've just kind of got a head start on us in this. So we're always playing catch up in this game, which is just kind of outrage generation. You know, the hard right are always going to be one step ahead on that, and it's a game they play better, and maybe it's a game that that left and liberal people shouldn't be playing. You say also that in the book that, that quitting anger, as you put it, is a moral choice. And I think that's something that that pops up in the book quite a lot. It's something you talk about is that this is a book about personal choices rather than political programs necessarily.
Yeah, that's why it kind of mutes some people who were expecting some political, you know, political realpolitik book or a revolutionary cookbook. But it is about personal choices. And yeah, quitting anger has been a moral choice for me because, you know, I am in this situation. I left my country. I'm living in Zagreb. I'm writing in English mostly now. You know, this therapist conversation that you mentioned in the book, in the beginning, yeah, I noticed that I quit anger because I am in the mode of survival. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to survive in this country. I'm trying to survive in English. I'm trying to survive without my loved ones around me and so on. You know, several other things. And pandemic made everything even worse. That's not needless to say. So I noticed that anger is taking too much time and energy from me. That kind of, you know, expression of anger and, you know, display of anger constantly. So that is why I am more attentive, more full of attention towards reality now. And this also, you know, anger is not a emotional space where thoughts are occurring necessarily. And when you're too angry, you cannot really see the mechanism, the parts of the mechanism and how that mechanism works. And that mechanism is the thing that makes you angry in the beginning. So only through attention, you can see the mechanism and you can turn around the mechanism, if you will. I'm talking about political mechanism here. So yeah, this is why attention is important, because it kind of stops us this excessive expression of anger stops us from talking about the subject and talking about what we are going to do next or what we are going to do to stop this, you know, whatever the political malaise is. So, yeah, attention is a very refined form of anger, and it needs no show of anger.
You talk. You mentioned a couple times you're living in Zagreb now. So you've been there for how long?
Well, it has been almost 5 years now.
Years.
Unbelievable.
So
you know, I just read Adorno. I saw a quote from Adorno on Twitter yesterday. It's amazing. He said, for those men who have no more a homeland, writing is a home. And I noticed that I said the same thing. So I think we are going through similar processes with those who felt homeless or who were homeless during the Second World War. You know, these are, I think, you know, we're, in terms of intellectual zeitgeist, we are repeating the time of Nazi regime. It was a time where several people asked the same question, is humankind evil? And I think, although there is no Nazism, although there is no fascism in uniforms or boots, I think many of us, again, started asking this question, is human evil? Because we have been, you know, subjected to too much banality, evil of banality or banality of evil. So I think many of us are thinking about this question. So this initial question gave us Freud, Hannah Arendt, Adorno, and several others, or Eric Fromm. And now I think the, you know, intellectual zeitgeist will come to a place where we will be discussing this question, and we will try to prove ourselves that humankind is not completely horrible. I think this is the time for that kind of question now.
Do you think, I mean, again, if you look at back at writers, you know, writing in the 30s, you know, I think one of my favorites is Joseph Roth, who was, you know, had to escape Vienna and go to Paris. Now, obviously, Paris in the 1930s was full of exiled writers, but does that exile, I know you talk about being in survival mode, and, you know, being on a different footing, but I don't know if you like using the word exile, but there is a trope of the exiled writer having a keener eye. Do you feel that's true?
Well, Albert Camus said once that all writing is exile writing, all literature is exile literature. That is, I think, kind of true. I don't like the word exile because it puts me in this impossible position, or, you know, it brands me forever, because once you're in exile, you're in exile, even if you go back home. Mm-hmm. So that's why I don't like the word. I try to take it as a journey, and this part of the journey. No. But I think we are once more going through a period of time where the free thinkers feel homeless. Mm-hmm. Even if they are in their homeland.
Yeah.
I think this is becoming a reality in Britain, in the United States, in several other countries as well. Mm-hmm. And that worries me. And this is why I wanted to write this together, because the loneliness that we are suffering from, the survival mode that we are all in, all, you know, people who think, who worry about the world situation and so on, we need to come together, because there is this loneliness which will eventually will make us Stefan Zweigs of 21st century, whereas I'd rather, you know, build another Frankfurt School.
Ambitious, but why not?
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So I guess, I mean, in some way, it sounds slightly glib to say, but the past year has made that intellectual loneliness and isolation become a very physical and real and visceral thing, in a way that people may not have kind of recognized before. That literally the impossibility, as you say, of traveling, of, you know, you would normally, you know, normally now you would be spending the next 3 months on the road,
mm-hmm.
you know, going to every festival across Europe and beyond and so on, and meeting all these people and having all these great conversations and all these incidental side conversations and meeting new people to have different conversations. And yeah. None of that can happen now.
No. Ironically, the book is called Together, and I am constantly at my dinner table doing these Zooms in my you know, plastic flowers. Yeah. Well, I was thinking about this today, actually. There are two kinds of writers, as far as I know. One kind feeds on books and texts. They get their nourishment from the writing. And the other kind is they get the nourishment from real life. I am, unfortunately, the second type. You know, it is unfortunate the pandemic happened, so there is no, you know, togetherness, or there are no new people.
Mm-hmm.
So it affects me a lot. The pandemic affected me a lot. No, and like any other middle-class bourgeois, I turn to nature. But how long can you hug a tree, huh?
You mentioned in the Frankfurt School, and that's, I think, a neat kind of segue into something that comes up in the book that I found very interesting, was you're very critical of, I think, yourself, maybe, and your peers. In the turn, you describe in the 90s how suddenly something called, you know, finance and the financial correspondent happened, the business correspondent happened, and the, I guess, capital took over that side of talking about material things and money, and the left, for want of a better phrase, you know, took over culture. And decided that we could understand everything in terms of meta narratives and discourse rather than factory outputs. When did you first come to kind of realize that as a problem? I know it's something that happened here a lot, kind of, and I guess it kind of came right through the 80s with Foucault and so on, you know, and so many people were fascinated by these things, but did it become a dead end?
Yeah. Well, okay, let's put this in context. I started journalism in 1993. I was 19, and this is 90s now. And then I was 27 when I became a political columnist in mainstream media. And it was the beginning of 2000, I think. I noticed there's something wrong here. Like, we are having a lot of fun with Lacan and Bourdieu and everybody. And then, you know, I don't remember exactly when, but there was a time when Edward Said threw a stone and everybody applauded and so on. So yeah, it was then I thought, okay, we're having fun. We are reading every situation. Narrative and so on, but the real life is not happening there. And then, of course, you know, I read and so on, and then I saw that actually the leftists and the progressives were ousted from that agora where, you know, the economy is taking place. It was an actual defeat. And that is why we took shelter in this cultural criticism and all that nice stuff that I love, but then it doesn't really change the world, does it? And then, I did it as well without even noticing what I am doing, you know, talking about poor people as if this is a narrative, this life. I think it's a defeat, but also it is how shall I put it? Somehow, the elite intellectuals, many of them, had made a peace with this fact. And they were, you know, earning money. They were having, you know, positions and so on. So, yeah, this was a this was a defeat, and we went to in that shelter of cultural criticism, and we gave up on economy. We gave up understanding economy, which is a horrible thing. I don't know if you remember, like it was 2008, you know, after the housing bubble crisis, we all went on Google and looked the word derivative. What is derivative? No, seriously. I'm like, I spent days trying to understand what the derivative is, and it was already too late. And there were many people understanding what it is and making capitalizing on it and so on. So yeah, many people think that Michael Moore, I mentioned him in the book, Michael Moore is a populist and, you know, he's fun, but he did something important. He made me understand what a derivative is. I think we have to do more of that, because it might be a very old school of understanding of being an intellectual, but we owe, those who know owe to the other people. I think so. Michael Moore is one of them, one of those who is paying his debt back to the society. So yeah, we should be doing more of that. I think we should be understanding economy. I'm like, we are not idiots.
Yeah. But
most of the time, we feel like idiots when there is, you know, these you know, market guys, traders, and so on. They speak of this world in a different way, and we don't understand their world. We have to understand it, because that is where the reality happens. That is where the real stuff is happening.
I think what's an element that's fascinating for me, and it's something that's playing out more and more in the UK now, with a government that's decided to get involved in culture wars. Suddenly they've become obsessed now with how history is taught in schools, and how, which is, you know, it's taught adequately, and you know what plays are put on in theatres and so on in a very odd way, and it feels like sometimes, you know, having, as you said, the left having in the 80s and 90s, kind of in the early 2000s, taken shelter in culture, it feels a little like the right is coming for culture now too.
Absolutely. Actually, this I have to confess something. Since I started writing this book, or like, I wouldn't say that, like since a few months, I'm not following British and American politics as closely as I did and after Have to Lose the Country. And I am blessed. I'm so happy that I don't have to follow for a while. And so that's why I didn't know about this. But okay, if you ask me like 2 years ago, I would have told you that this would happen. Actually, I think there was a sentence in How to Lose the Country. You might think that you're going to, you know, confine yourself to your personal spaces, but there won't be any personal space. They will come for you there as well.
There's a great George Orwell article he wrote for Tribune about meeting someone in the Cafe Royale during an air raid, and the young artist says he doesn't care whether the Nazis win or not, because he's an artist and he'll still have his art. Mm. And Orwell tries to explain to him, no, that's not how it works.
Absolutely.
That's not how it works. But I think, you know, certainly, you know, if you look at, I recall a piece, a short piece I wrote a few years ago, when the everyone suddenly here talking about Ottomanization and how this was the new thing that Erdogan was demanding.
And they were... Then there were hipsters who were, you know, completely, I don't know, detached from the reality that only the poor and the political people have to suffer. And then they found themselves in ballot boxes trying to, you know, stop the poll rigging. So, yeah, it doesn't matter where you are. I mean, there is no way, there is no space out of politics. One has to... First of all, realize this, there is no space out of politics. So, there is this new generation, which interests me most nowadays. They're on TikTok. They're not interested in politics at all and so on. And I wonder when they're going to understand that their space is not apolitical, or it is not outside politics. Yeah, and also cultural domination. That, by the way, Erdogan is now constantly talking about producing culture, and they are trying to do that. And while trying to do that, they are harvesting intellectuals and artists from the progressives and from the, you know, former leftists and so on. It is, there has been a moral discussion, you know, about what to do in this situation for artists, among artists lately in Turkey. But yeah, I mean, like, how can a regime survive without producing its culture? Of course, of course they're going to produce the culture. And unfortunately, I have to say this, you'll be surprised how many people will compromise. Yeah, and that is the most heartbreaking thing. It is not the, you know, right-wing populists doing this and that. Actually, the most heartbreaking thing for the progressives is that there'll be many people, not many, but there'll be enough people that would give in and that would be very happy to be in the same picture with Boris Johnson, Erdogan, whatever.
Mm-hmm. You say, I mean, there is a whole generation coming up who you know, may think they can stay political until the politics comes to them. But at the same time, you talk in the book about new movements who are very engaged personally, I guess, but there isn't what older generation would have seen as a coherent movement as such. There are things that ebb and flow. And I think how you put it, you say that people go back, you know, when I'm quoting your own line here, when they're met with massive state violence, they retreat to their sleeping cells rather than choosing to arm themselves as previous generations have done. And they're mostly overcautious about protecting the boundaries of individuality, but can act as a synchronized and unified entity. How does that, what's the I guess the question is, what's the future in that? Because I think we're in this interregnum between kind of, I guess, organized party politics and what comes next. And we're still trying to figure out, particularly on the left, particularly trying to figure out what comes next.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, what comes next? Before Gezi protests happened in Turkey, I should call it uprising, actually. Actually, 3 years before that, the high school kids started protesting something about the, you know, exams. And they were in city centers. They were not big groups. They were in the city centers and so on. And that was the first time after 1980, the military coup, that I saw high school kids on the street protesting something. And I wrote about this and I said, in 3 or 4 years, you're going to see something big happening. And I think this is the next thing. Now we're seeing all these, you know, Extinction Rebellion kids, you know, climate strike kids, and I shouldn't be calling them kids. I'm very sorry to say this, young people. And they're going to go into universities in a few years. And then let's watch what's happening. I think something big is going to happen in a few years. That's on global level. But before that, meanwhile, something else will happen. These new political organisms that we can, you know, we can see them as the children or the, you know, the fruits of World Social Forums, Occupy movements, and so on. I think these new political organisms, which are quite, you know, amorphous at this point, will somehow, like fish, as I told this in the book, like fish, they're going to you know, surround the wreck of political institutions, the, you know, collapsing political institutions, and they're going to bring them into life. And this is happening in Turkey, and, and, you know, the mayor elections was the first big political opposition against, challenge against Erdogan. In Istanbul, Izmir, and Ankara, three big cities now run by opposition mayors. And actually, on Sunday in Zagreb, the same thing happened again. I mean, this is a country where rising right-wing populism is a big issue. And a mayor who is a progressive politician is about to win the elections, let's say that. And because I think all those cultural criticism people or people who divided understanding and action somewhere around 90s. And those people who think that if we can live, you know, in narrow space, in our artistic space, everything will be over. All those people who were who did not go into real politics for such a long time are now noticing that their life, their life spaces are under threat, and unless they do real politics, they're going to be victims of a regime, of an oppressive regime, of or authoritarian regimes. And this is for every, you know, I'm saying this for several countries, especially for Turkey.
Yes. Okay. I think we'll, you know, come to the end here. And I know you said before that one of the, you know, we talk about being the exiled writer, and you know, I remember you telling me before about how, you know, sometimes you can feel like a panned on display. Asked, like, what can we do to help you, this endangered species? But I guess, again, reversing that question, what should we be doing now? What's your one piece of, I guess, advice now that you, that from Together that you would ask people to follow?
Believe in me. No, the book is ending like, you know, I believe in you, you believe in me, and you know, something like that is a better ending, of course. But yeah, I think I want people to believe in what I say. Not I'm not saying this out of, you know, author narcissism. It is more like, you know, I've been through some hardcore shit, and my country as well. It went through real hardcore times. And it all comes to having faith in humankind and in ourselves, actually. So that's why I say, please believe in me. And I really want to believe in you, personally, you, Padraig, and and the reader of this book. I am sometimes concerned that, you know, the book is yellow and it's called Together and, you know, several other things. If people did not read How to Lose a Country, they might think that this book is naive. It is not naive. It is attempting to be naive. And it is asking the question, why do you think these words sound naive to you? No.
That's a great note to end on. Ajit Malgren, thank you very much.
Thank you, Padraig. It was a pleasure, as always.
This episode of Little Atoms was presented by me, Padraig Reedy, and edited by Sky Redman. Little Atoms is supported by 89UP and hosted by Acast. If you enjoyed the show, please do subscribe and rate us on iTunes, and even tell a friend. And remember to check out littleatoms.com for a full archive. Thank you for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.